All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Magnus and Marcus podcast. This time, it's a special edition of our episode. For the only second time in our, 18, 19 episodes, we'll have a third wheel in this conversation. So,
I like to say special guest, Steve, someone who would come on for our heady appearance fee of $0 and 0 cents.
We do pay the big bucks on this one. We beg everyone to come on. So,
So it's just like the sport of track and field. I like this.
Yes.
Exactly. So that third voice you hear is a professional track athlete, former NCAA champion, Phoebe Wright. Welcome, Phoebe.
Hello.
All right. Well, we were talking off air, and in between the beeping sound from John parking the van, we decided to talk a little bit about your story. And what I mean by that is, let's start with how you viewed professional track, maybe when you started running and through your college career, and then we'll go on through how you view it now.
And as a preface, Phoebe, we like to give the people what they want, so we want to hear about your war wounds, because we know every soldier has a story to tell.
Got it. I'll be sure to include all the juicy details of my days spent crying with my sunglasses at the 100-meter mark. You know, all this stuff. but, yeah, I really like this idea because I've had 4 or 5 identity crises, especially over the past, 2 years. But for those who don't know my story, I walked on to the Tennessee track team. And before I got to day one of practice, I thought I was the best thing since sliced bread. And then day one of practice, I realized that the fastest I could possibly run for 4 miles would be an easy jog for Sarah Bowman. And I realized that there are a lot of good runners out there, and I wasn't one of them. So being in that situation, I zoomed in. So I like to think of this analogy when I'm in a weird position and things seem hopeless. I either zoom in or I zoom out of the situation. So in that case, I zoomed in so far in that I took it literally step by step. And over the course of my collegiate career, I couldn't really see anything. Like, if today was Friday, I couldn't see anything past, Saturday at 8 a.m. I knew exactly what I needed to do, and it was, a checklist, and I was just checking the boxes and trying hard. And by the time I got to my senior year and I allowed myself to zoom out, that was when I realized all that I had accomplished. And I didn't realize how rare it is just to keep plugging away at something and keep improving and not really having many setbacks over a 4-year period. And I guess in college I was so zoomed in, I didn't appreciate. I just took it for granted. I thought it was normal. I thought that everybody just go in, did exactly what they needed to do day by day, and then step back for a second and was like, oh, well, that was easy. Almost like if you ever have hiked a mountain, you just only look down at the rocks that you need to avoid. And then before you know, you're looking up at this amazing view and you're like, how did I even get up this mountain because it's so high? But, so when I entered in the professional world, I really honestly thought it was going to be like that. I was just going to go and go to practice every day and try really hard and be really tough and keep steadily improving. I would get a couple American records, win a couple world medals, and then retire and move on to whatever I felt I wanted to do. And then while my first year as a professional, it started out with a bang, and then I just totally fried myself. And ever since then, it's like I've been derailed and just floundered to find my way. It was like I was sipping the Kool-Aid for 4 years and believed this fairy tale story that if you just work hard, then you'll achieve what you can, whatever you put your mind to. And 99% of the time, it doesn't work out that way. Like, you have a really spectacular athletes line up on the line who try guaranteed just as hard as the other seven athletes out there, and there's only one winner, and a lot of times it's out of your control. So when I kind of realized that idea, that I didn't believe the fairy tale story that the harder you work, the better results you get, I had like an identity crisis. Like, what's the point? Why am I here? Can I ever be number one in the world? What if I don't have the talent of a Jenny Simpson? What if I can't physically train as hard as Brenda Martinez? Or I just kind of started to doubt myself and doubt what I was doing. And then on top of that, I was kind of like thinking, like, why do I even run in the first place? Like, nobody really even cares about a race 10 minutes after the race is won. Why do I run? Is it to impress people? Because that seems shallow. Or is it to get the best out of myself? Because I could do that and not have so much heartbreak as this sport. So I think that that was kind of my last year. Like, I zoomed so far out that running didn't even register on my map. So, but like this year, I actually got a little bit of traction and a little bit of hope, and it kind of re-sparked my why do I do this. And I shifted from results oriented and trying to impress people and trying to impress myself to like this process oriented mindset, to where, yeah, okay, I might not be number one in the world, but I'm sure as heck I'm gonna try, because maybe the stars will align, maybe they won't, but if they do align, I want to have done everything in my power to be there to capitalize on it, because those little wins are so satisfying and they more than make up for the down times. So yeah, I guess I've just practiced a lot now, not focusing on other people or sponsors or doping or any of those negatives, and just focusing on what I can do every day to make me happy and make me better. Because it's very satisfying to master something. And even if you aren't receiving the results that you want, just the process of mastery is well worth the work that you put in.
Sounds good, Phoebe. You know, your story is not very atypical, right? You have an NCAA champion, someone who had a lot of success, kicking ass, taking names, you know, winning Penn relays, this and that. And then you go off into the quote-unquote professional track and field world, and, you know, all these NCAA champions that ran stellar times in college, you never really materialize or even get back to that apex that they're at, where, like, every race felt like the next best thing. Can you talk a little bit about the shift in mindset? I mean, you talked about zooming in and zooming out, but what were, like, the biggest distractions or barriers to success when you're a collegiate athlete versus now your biggest distractions and what you felt have led barriers to success post-collegiately?
Yeah, so it's just a totally different sport. In college, you're managing academics, and the competition isn't as steep, and it's 8 months a year instead of, like, a really intense 3 months a year. And, like, if you really think about it, you're really only racing, you know, the top juniors and seniors that have kind of survived this lifestyle. So the competition just isn't as steep. So when you go into a dual meet and you can just beat up on people, you get this confidence and ego around you that you just really feel invincible. So when you go to the big stage, you think that just nothing can happen to you, and you're going to, you know, waltz on the track, win the race, do your victory lap, and then walk off like it's normal. So the biggest thing I've had to do in the professional world is appreciate how that's not normal, and for how many times I've done that and just executed a race plan perfectly. Like, I was tough as heck in college, and now shifting my perception of what is normal. So, like, when I line up now, I don't think that a win is guaranteed. But I do think that I can be successful and execute a plan regardless of what's going on around me, which is in a lot of ways harder. Like, it's a lot harder for a mid-level NCAA athlete to go and run their best race than it is for a top-level NCAA athlete just to go win. Because, like, just winning is so much more simple. But now you might not win. So you have to, like, have all these variables and put yourself in position to capitalize on it if you can win, but not hate yourself and go cry in a corner if you can't win.
Okay, good. Another, like, as you're talking, another question too, you know, that popped into mind. I mean, since you've kind of had this multiple awakenings or several identity crises, as you've alluded to, and you're now in a little bit more deliberate, process-oriented space, if you were to go back and coach yourself for your first 2 years out of college, what would you change, or what would you do, what would you coach yourself those first 2 years to get the most out of you, set you up for success, and hopefully have a little less of, you know, peaks and valley type career post, usually in those, you know, very formative first 2 years out of the NCAA?
Oh, gosh. There's a million things that I would want to tell my 22 and 23-year-old self, and I would have been totally unreceptive to any of the advice that I would about to give myself. Because I was in a system in college that had a lot of success, so I thought that that's just, you know, the only successful program. I thought that was the only way to be top of the world. And now I kind of realize that there's a lot of different paths to success, and that the workouts, like, if you were going to make a list of what makes a successful athlete, like, attitude and environment would be number one, and training would be, like, number 10. Like, the workouts that you do are so – that work is work, and the workouts that you do are not the end-all be-all of what makes a successful athlete. So I guess I would have told my younger self to find an environment that completes me as a person. Like, for the first 4 years of my professional career, I was only a professional runner. And when that wasn't working out, it was like panic buttons started going off. So I would have, like, I would have valued a career outside of track. The idea of a career outside of track never even crossed my mind. I thought that, you know, I was just going to be world champion, and then I would figure out what to do after that, and money wouldn't be an issue, and I wouldn't have to, like, worry about any of these weird adult things, like health insurance and a mortgage payment. And I was just so delusional, almost. And I kind of took for granted how hard it is to be successful in this sport. So I'm actually reading Tina Fey's book right now, and she says treat your career like a bad boyfriend, meaning, like, don't prioritize them, because you don't want to prioritize something that can hurt you so bad. So I now, like, think about my career kind of like a bad boyfriend. Like, don't want it. Don't want the end result so bad. Don't want the end goal. Just kind of, like, go with the flow and chill out for a second, and don't put all of your eggs in the professional running basket, because it's too volatile of a career path.
So I think that's a really interesting point, because a lot of times college athletes making that transition to pro have this misconception that you have to live this kind of Spartan, like, hardcore runner life where all you do is run, then come home, sit around for 7 hours, and run again, right? And it's like running has to be the only focus. And from your little talk there, and I know you going back to school, for example, like, it seems like you've taken the approach of trying to find balance in your life. So how do we get college-age kids to realize that this they shouldn't follow this misnomer of running is all I can do, I'm just going to do this, and everything else in life is put on hold, and if I don't do that, I'm not going to be successful?
Yeah. So I actually really struggle with this idea because I'm not sold on the idea that you can be as successful not living the Spartan lifestyle. So, like, my current identity crisis is, like, how many hours do I take in school? Because is that going to take away from running? Maybe I do need to live the Galen Rupp, like, sit at home, only think about running, like, lifestyle. And that's the best way to success. And I don't really know how to reconcile the two philosophies. because it's, I don't like to line up admitting that the odds of me winning this race objectively are not high. And the Spartan lifestyle doesn't even allow that to be a thought. It's just more heartbreaking and not a good life plan overall, especially if you're viewing it as a career, like your financial career, to live that way. I don't know. That's just my current crisis right now. And I'm taking the Buddhist approach of go with the flow and be balanced. But it hasn't, like, I haven't had as much success doing that lifestyle as I did when I was just zoomed in, checking away the boxes.
Well, I mean, it's funny to talk about Buddhism, Phoebe, because a lot of things which you're speaking to is, you know, the different paths to enlightenment that are prevalent in the Buddhist culture. So, you know, a child is enlightened, right? Because they're enlightened through innocence. And it's not like when you're in college, you're enlightened, you're clicking on all cylinders because you're just innocent to what the realities of post-collegiate or professional track and field were, because that's where really, really good people are all competing to be the best in the world. And, you know, as we know, when you're trying to be the best in the world at anything, that's really tough. And versus you couple that with the enlightenment of the true enlightenment that has the depth of suffering behind it, the depth of, you know, kind of living through the shit in the world, you know, pardon my French here, but that enlightenment has a lot more, you know, angles and dimensions to it than the enlightenment of a child. And so it's, in the Buddhist perspective, you know, and for all you Buddhists out there, sorry if I, you know, make this way too oversimplified, that's what the living the life is going through all this kind of suffering and then still finding that enlightenment. And so even though, you know, your process, and, you know, I definitely appreciate you coming on here being vulnerable, you're still on that journey, you know, I think you can take some solace in the fact that the reality is you're further along than most because you've stepped outside this innocence of just, you know, being very siloed, checking off the boxes, just doing this, doing that, because it's like you want, when you do have success, when you do actually finally get the result that is requisite of the process that you put in, the depth and the joy is a lot deeper. That's why you see, right, at the Olympics, when an athlete crosses the finish line, even though they might have been, like, you know, the American record holder or national record holder or world champion or world record holder or whatever, winning the Olympic, you see most people just break down in those tears, because the weight of everything they've gone through to get to that pinnacle, to just kind of have a little bit of luck, you know, coupled with their preparation to on that given day in the summer every 4 years to get to that height. But yet we also know, right, if you're very solely result-oriented, what happens is you get that post, you know, Olympic or post-result depression, whether you hit the result or not. And I think what I've heard from you, you've gone from very much a result-oriented mindset to be the best, win races, which every competitive person wants to do, to actually be more enjoying the process and then being excited about your preparations and your craftsmanship or craftswomanship here to create the sense of mastery that I do this as well as I can for me, and my process is unique and exciting. And so when I go into a race or when I go into a competitive scene, I have a lot of fun with it. Because I remind athletes all the time, you know, running is very, very simple. It's one foot in front of the other and have fun. And talk about a little bit, you know, because what I've heard, kind of reading between the lines, is you lost some of that fun when you lost the competitive, like, oh, I'm going to easily win this race. And when the result of winning came into doubt, like, how have you reconciled, you know, getting the fun back into your training and racing, even though the guarantee of a win or is not as solidified as it once was in your scholastic setting?
Yeah, that's been very hard because I went from a program that was really intense and every day was kind of like do or die. So when I joined Danny's program and it's very much more relaxed, I was going into it with the mindset of do or die, which is not favorable of a mindset. And so now I kind of equate it to studying. When you're studying, studying isn't that fun, but when you have the aha moment where it all just kind of clicks together for a minute, that's like the moment that you kind of chase. That's why you do all this work. You believe that it's you're going to have the aha moment. So like when I do repeat thousands and I'm just chugging away at them, just like each rep that I complete and I do well and I work hard, I have like the satisfaction of mastery. And taking those little wins has kind of, I've like kind of, I guess, brainwashed myself into thinking that that's fun, like pushing yourself to hurt and overcoming the hurt is what's the fun part about running.
Yeah, that's a, I mean, that's an interesting take on how you've kind of compartmentalized and figured that out. I mean, in hearing your story, I can't help but think like, you know, in dealing with professionals for a couple of years now, of how similar it is. It's almost like you come out of this college setting and everyone has this almost innocence, this naivete about them, about how the world of sport works. And then you see this a lot, like this crisis of, this isn't the sport I signed up for kind of deal, or this isn't how I expected it to work. And you see this process of people figuring out how to redefine themselves, how to make themselves work in that environment. I was wondering if maybe you could touch on, I know you've been on the sport for a couple of years, but me and we've all seen in this podcast very talented athletes, NCAA champions, you know, et cetera, who have come out maybe the first year or two and done pretty well, but then kind of given up on that sport when they've hit in that loss of innocence of how it works. Like, how do you deal with losing that innocence and that naiveness and still figuring out how to, you know, survive in the sport?
Yeah, it's a brutal sport because it's not fair and it's a little bit ugly. So my roommate has a stress fracture, and he has a stress fracture because he tried really, really hard to keep up with Garrett for X amount of months. And it's not fair. You just want life to work. Like, the harder you try and the more you deserve it, the better result you're going to get. And that's not how anything in life works. And it's a terrible realization when you figure that out, that, like, you don't always get what you put in. But on the flip side, you do always come out a better person for however much you put in. So I like to think that running has made me more patient and more dedicated and more empathetic towards people and towards injuries, and taking those intangibles and putting them in the bank for all of the energy that you've expended out is kind of what you have to do. Because if you like harp on the injuries and be like, it's not fair, I don't deserve to be hurt, or if you harp on the dopers and be like, it's not fair, I should have gotten second and Maria Savinova shouldn't have been in a race, or you can always line up the cards as to how the universe has just been against you. But you could do that in any situation, in any job. And so instead of focusing and harping on all of those negative details, you have to notice that there's a whole slew of positives that maybe aren't tangible that you got out of the experience.
Good, like it. Sorry, this is quickly turning into like 21 questions with Phoebe Wright, everybody. But but I mean, you know, Phoebe, you're such a dynamic personality, and you've kind of gone through this whole gauntlet, not just physically, spiritually, and emotionally. But you know, the thing that separates you is you're also pretty vocal. I know you have a very robust following on the social media worlds, and you always provide entertaining and valuable content. And one thing, you know, you and I have talked a lot about is just ways in which we could change the sport to really be more athlete-focused and friendly. So my curiosity to you is, like, if you had to go back and you had to, you know, in the beginnings of U.S. or the beginnings of track and field professional arena, if you had to go and you were in charge of how we're going to structure professional track and field, what would you do, you know, as an athlete now and seeing all the unfairness and politics behind this team, how would you structure it so the athletes are very well taken care of and given a little bit better opportunity to thrive rather than just be, you know, another barcode or name on a piece of paper that goes through this carousel of intermittent faces and brands and yada, yada, yada?
Yeah, I question a lot. I think that a lot of nurses are going to these inspirational stories. So, like, thinking about Emily Anfeld, this past world championship, people need to know her story. People need to know that you go from crying every night for 8 weeks while you have a broken hip to maybe the stars align. Like, just having that hope and having these stories and ambassadors that are good, genuine people, being able to, like, make them accessible to the public. I feel like I'm so not accessible. I try and expose myself and my personality, but it's just so hard to get that reach. And I would like to see companies take advantage of the stories that athletes have to tell. And because that's what makes sport fun, is you develop an emotional attachment to a person or team or player, and then you want them to win, and you're, like, on this bandwagon with them. And I would like to see, so sponsors have more, invest more in exposing the athletes. I think that meets could be more organized and more fun. So, like, the Portland track meet this past, at the end of, beginning of August, was an amazing example of how meets should be run. They had professional athletes out there as, like, ambassadors to the crowd. They got the crowd involved. There was a beer garden. It was only a two-hour meet. Regular people, regular runners could come in and run the beginning races of the meet and then stay and watch the professionals. And I bet that a lot of money was made in the beer garden and the admission fees. And it was such a great environment for every person out there. So the sport could be something great. It could be inspirational to people. It could be entertaining to people. It could be everything and more, as, like, what football or soccer is. But it's just so corporate right now, feeling that we've just missed the boat. And I feel like I'm only as good as what I ran last week.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think we all agree there's a lot of things wrong in our sport and a lot of things that we could do. And I think one of the issues, I know we've all talked before about, is that our sport is one that's not very organized from an athletic standpoint, from an athlete standpoint, in the sense that it's like we've talked about, like, you come in as a college athlete, get signed by some sponsor, you're naive for the first couple years, you learn how it works, and by the time you learn how it works and how to maybe get your story out there, or how to, you know, meander through the bureaucratic stuff that is track and field, it's like you're upper 20s and you're on your way out. So how do you think we could, or do you think there's a way that we could do better as athletes to have some sort of input from the get-go, from college to pro?
Yeah, I think that a huge way to solve that problem is to keep the people who have, like, been through the gauntlet and realize how to do things, keep them in the sport. Like, Alan Webb needs to be an ambassador for the sport. He needs to be talking to all of these young runners that are coming out. He needs to be just a face for shoe companies. Lauren Fleshman does a great job of that. We just need those people to kind of bring up the younger crowd and then have the manpower to actually change the sport.
I agree with that. I mean, you know, you typically see that a lot. A lot of the infrastructure exists in the, you know, NFL, MLB, and NBA, where you have, like, say, Jerome Kersey, who recently passed away unexpectedly, was just a general ambassador for the Portland Trailblazers, because he was one of the most beloved Portland Trailblazers here in, you know, Rip City. And he would just go out and go in the community and do a variety of things, whether it's kiss babies and shake hands, go play some old guy pickup games, attend games with, you know, Blazer alums. Like, you know, you really see that model work in the professional ranks with these, you know, organizations. And I think you and I and Steve all see that opportunity there to have, like, an Allen or, you know, even like, say, Kara Goucher or, you know, other athletes who have been in it for a little while and gone through highs and lows and the pinnacle. I mean, it'd be invaluable. Like, Phoebe, think about it, like, if you had sat down and you actually had, like, a, you know, like a rookie camp of sorts where you were just told by not necessarily a federation, but by other athletes, hey, here's how it's going to be. Here's what you're going to deal with, you know, young buck. I mean, think of it like how much impact that might change your, you know, awareness or rapidly expand your vision in that short time versus having to go through this gauntlet you've had the past couple of years. And now coming to the state here in your mid 20s, where you're like, oh, I get it now, you know? So I think that's real valuable insight. You know, we've talked a lot about, like, kind of what's wrong or a lot of things that, you know, or struggles you've had or insights you've had going kind of through this quagmire of mud, so to speak. But, you know, always, again, going back to Eastern philosophy, look at, you know, you need to have a mud for the lotus flower to grow, right? No mud, no lotus. So, you know, thinking on that terms, what are some of, like, your favorite things? Like, why do you keep running? Why do you keep coming back? What keeps you motivated and excited to stick after it year after year, despite all the cry sessions, all the identity crisis, all the bureaucracy you've had to deal with?
Yeah, it's actually been a lot easier to come back and be motivated now that I have school, because I'm not competing to put food on my table anymore, and I feel like I'm advancing my career, so I don't feel like I'm wasting time if it doesn't pan out. I got a little bit of my innocence back and a little bit of my like just doing it for the love. But I think the biggest thing that keeps me in the sport is my team, just coming to practice every day and not only being motivated by Katie Mackey, my personal cheerleader, but motivating Megan Malasarte, and she's my little like my little sister, and I don't want her to go through all of the struggles that I almost unnecessarily went through. So I've been like guiding the ropes with her, and if I don't accomplish anything else before I leave the sport, I want to make sure that she's set up as best as she possibly can to have the best career that she can. So like having those goals that make you feel valuable as a person is kind of what's keeping me alive and keeping me wanting to do this for a few more years.
Oh, that's good. I mean, that's, you know, human nature, it's about connection, right? And I think we've seen this influx of, you know, clubs and groups and teams starting to form in the last several years. I mean, you know, you have the Nike-based clubs, and now Adidas has clubs, New Balance, and now Brooks with the Beast. Can you talk a little bit, like, kind of going from, you know, a pretty intense team environment in Tennessee to then a pretty intense kind of solo professional, you know, stint to now, like, being a part of, you know, the Beast Club? And just what were some of the differences and advantages to each? And, you know, really, you know, like, what makes like, the Beast, you know, club and situation up in Seattle a little different than most?
Yeah, so at Tennessee, I felt like it was Tennessee against the world, and it was almost like a militant feel, and which was satisfying because I felt like I was a tiny piece of something that was so great, like putting up 10 points towards an NCAA win was, it was like I just got my little piece of hard work that went into something amazing. So like one of my favorite things in life is when you have a group of people all working together towards something. So that's why I love going to sporting events, because I love being in a crowd that's rooting for the same thing, or concerts, or anything where there's a group setting all pulling for one thing. And so I hated it as a solo professional. That's not my jam. I felt selfish. I didn't know why I was running. I felt like I had no purpose. And so then when I joined the Beast, I kind of got the best of all worlds, because I got the I matter and my results matter part of running back. But I also got the intangibles of helping other team members kind of reach their potential. And it's in a much more relaxed, fun, process-oriented environment that's not do or die. So I guess I've just come kind of full circle, like taking what I want out of the team, applied it to my new team, and now hopefully we'll have a bit of success before I retire.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point, because not to tie some research into it, but there's some really cool research that shows that if you just look at performance, right, those who have some greater than oneself's purpose tend to have higher performances than those who don't. And there's actually been some cool research looking at, for example, like dealing with fatigue and pushing boundaries of fatigue, and your body letting you go to a level that normally you can't go if you have some higher purpose, whether that's doing it for a team or doing it for some religious purpose or whatever. That's why you see people thank God at the end of races and stuff like that. But basically not getting in this selfish mindset of I'm doing this for myself and I'm going to run well and people are going to notice me and all that stuff, which I think is sometimes hard to get out of when you're in the professional athlete setting, because it truly is all about you in the beginning. Because it's like your career, it's your paycheck, all that matters is how you do. So it's kind of cool to see you figure out how to navigate this professional selfish endeavor and create a team bigger than oneself's purpose beyond it.
Yeah, I like that. Because this sport is super selfish if you let it be. And when you cross the line and you win and you don't have anybody there to hug or congratulate or a teammate to get excited for, it can be a long road if you hit a roadblock.
Yeah, which inevitably we're all going to hit, right? I mean, the sport is incredibly selfish, but it's incredibly brutal too, because it's just you against, you know, it's you and your mind against the world, right? There's no, me and John as coaches can prepare you as best as possible when it's out on the track, it's just you out there, which I think sets it aside from almost any other sport besides maybe swimming and to a degree cycling out there. So it brings a different dynamic. So I think, you know, young athletes I see or young professionals I see transition a lot miss that boat, where they think they dive into that selfish pedigree and take it all for what it's worth, and miss that boat of making sure they have the right support group around them, which I think is incredibly important.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's my number one counsel to a lot of athletes, is creating that support dynamic and what that looks like from, you know, a coaching standpoint, you know, like strength and conditioning standpoint, just friends, mentors, you know, parents, you know, psychologists, whatever it is. It's like, you know, you want to have, it's about relationships at the end of the day. And I think, you know, it's really warms my heart to hear that, Phoebe, that, you know, someone of your caliber and your pedigree, who's had tremendous success at a variety of levels, is kind of, you know, come back down to earth and realize, okay, aha, this is really what it's about. These relationships that you make with each other and these bonds you make with different coaches or athletes that last a lifetime. And I think as we all mature and see that, that becomes more important than, you know, what did you win this Diamond League? Did you win, you know, this U.S. Championship? Did you do this? Did you do that? Because, you know, even though track can be very, very selfish in a lot of ways, it can also be very, very diluted, as you talk about, with so many different, you know, meets going on throughout the course of the year. I always relate track a lot to the, you know, musician or music industry. You can have solo artists, you can have acts, you can have someone who's part of a group go on a solo tour, you can do this, you can do that. There's all these concerts going on. Which concert is the biggest concert? You know, which is the one that must go to throughout the course of the year? You can have an all-star concert, you can have a reunion concert. It's like da-da-da-da-da-da. Same thing with this sport. And it's, I mean, I think that's, in some ways, it lends itself to people who can navigate the landscape of finding your place individually within you know, the map, but also too creating these like intersections with other people. So when you go to a meet, right, it's like, hey, it's all, you know, all these people that, you know, like we know on the pro circuit here in the US, like from the middle distance world, it's kind of, we all go to the same meets and we all hang out and we have fun. And even if we're like, we're not going to go compete at that meet, you see like people come up and come watching, like they did with that Flow Track Throwdown meet that you referenced in August up here in Portland. Like people just came and kicked it. And that was awesome, and that was enduring. You know, I think you made, you had a very, you know, poignant tweet a couple of weeks ago that I've been saying for years. It's like, hey, why is everyone spending $5,000 to $6,000 to go over to Europe to race each other when we can just do it here at home in the States? You know, I mean, talk about a little bit of that, like the mystique of Europe when you're young, you know, professional versus the reality of Europe once you kind of go and do it for a couple of years in that racing world.
Yeah, so Megan Malasarte, actually, she decided not to go over to Europe, and she was like, I'm having FOMO for not going over to Europe. And I was like, it's not what you think it is. You go over and you stay in like dorm rooms and you can't use your phone and you don't have easy access to a track or to a weight room, and you're racing for like €50 for the win, and there's 30 people there, and you just kind of get run down. Unless you're on the Diamond League circuit, the Flow Track Throwdown was 20 times bigger and more fun and involved better preparation than any of those Flanders Cups meets that you'll get in Europe. There's only like a handful of meets that are even worth going over for. So it is interesting going from, I need to go to Europe and race and prove myself, to why am I going over to Europe again? Like, let's yeah, go down to Portland.
Yeah. Well, I always talk to athletes about, you know, it's how you make a career, right? Like, you know, what, there's a lot of different ways you could be a professional in this sport. You could, you know, be someone who just runs for the money and just, hey, whatever pacing job or high prize money race is there, I'm going to go run for the money. Or you can be someone who just prepares to run championship events, and all I'm going to do is run championships and run to win. How, you know, have you, reconciled, or how do you deal with kind of those very two distinct different routes and not get distracted by one or the other? Because, you know, sometimes you're like, oh, well, I should race for the money to make money, to make a living so I can continue to race. Or it's like, well, I should put all my eggs into winning this championship or competing to win this championship or make this team. But they do have their drawbacks, you know, when that doesn't come to fruition. And I feel like my personal view is you can't do both. You have to pick what type of runner you are. Otherwise, you're going to be spread so thin, your bandwidth's not going to afford you to be effective in either form. So, you know, maybe talk a little bit about, you know, the choices you've made and going back and moving forward, like the choices you want to make and how you want to define your legacy or define, you know, the years you have left here as a professional runner.
Right. Yeah. So I've abandoned both of those plans and only gone to the meets that I have fun at. So after all of these years, I've like, I know what meets I don't like and what meets I do like, and I know what meets I can prepare for, and I know what meets will fit in my schedule. And I know that I can only race like 3 times a month realistically for 4 months, without breaking down. So, I basically go on the schedule that makes me the happiest, most productive runner, because, and for me, more than championships, is I just want to PR. So I want to be in those fast races, and like a PR to me is worth more than a championship spot. So that's kind of what I've geared my career goal to. So, yeah.
Awesome. That is even the best answer I could hope for, because you encapsulated, the fun part, which I think we lose track of so much in this post-collegiate world and running in general, it comes all result-oriented. You lose the fun. What are some ways you kind of keep it fun on a day-to-day basis and race-to-race basis, and what makes those fun races that you talk about fun? If you want to go in detail and call out those races, that'd be great. Just kind of curious, what separates a fun race from a not fun race in the world of Phoebe Wright?
Oh, gosh, the environment. I do not like going to a meet where there's like two people in the stands and it's just a time trial race. So I like a laid back environment. I like knowing that I will not have to struggle to find food, which is a common problem for me in Europe. And I like knowing that it's going to be easy travel. Like, I don't want to travel halfway across the world just to get on a track and race. I want to know that there's good competition. I don't want to do a dual meet. Like, I'd rather just do a practice than a dual meet. I guess the environment, the crowd, and how amped they are for it is kind of what makes me happy.
Well, good. What about in like training and preparation? Like, what where do you have the most fun? What's the most fun thing that you look forward to? Like, maybe a certain type of workout or a certain series of work blocks or just a certain dynamic. How is training still fun after all these years?
My favorite training days by far are when everybody on the team is out on the track and it is like an intense time trial day, because I love watching people time trial and run until they puke, and I like running until I puke, and I like other people to cheer for me while I do it.
Awesome. There is something comforting about like watching other people suffer and having like other people there while suffering. It's such a weird feeling, but like if other people are there, even if they're not doing the same thing as you, if other people there are like hurting, like it's so much easier to be like, okay, well, that sucks for them. This is going to suck for me. So it's all right. Let's just get this done then. Like if it's you by yourself. So that's really cool.
It's kind of why classic cross country is such a bonding experience, because everyone is out there on that course suffering.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Great answer.
How about this? I'm going to tackle the doping question real quick. How do you keep yourself energized in this sport and having fun with it and keeping hope that you can progress when you have to deal with, the recent doping allegations and all the 800 runners who have tested positive and all of those things? Like, how do you keep yourself focused and doing what you need to do without driving yourself up the wall thinking, how the hell am I supposed to compete with these people?
Yeah, that's just pure compartmentalization, because if I allowed myself to think about it, I would cry, punch some babies, and then quit the sport. So I don't even think about it there and in my race plan. Like, doping almost doesn't even exist when I'm on the track or at practice. When I think about how I'm going to execute my race plan, it doesn't depend on anybody. When I finish a race, if I lose, I don't make excuses that there were dopers in my race. It's just like, just keep moving forward and pretend doping doesn't exist. And hopefully I'll attack the doping world when I'm retired and a pharmacist.
Interesting.
Well, Phoebe, we saw a lot of questions at you. What questions do you have for Steve and I here, since you got both of us on the horn together, if any?
Oh, gosh. Do you guys honestly think that you can have success not living the Spartan lifestyle, like having the balance?
100%. I agree. Yes.
I do completely. I think there are certain runners who might tend to do the turn your brain off and do nothing, and they're okay with it. But I think certain runners thrive when they're given more things. I mean, I'll use my own life as an example. So when I obsessed over running, all I did was train myself to death and overtrain, right? But in my own running, when I had 10 different things going on, whether it was school or, you know, writing a book or doing whatever the hell, my running got better just from doing that stuff. And obviously, I wasn't running at the level you guys do, but I think you see that. For example, Sarah Hall does a fantastic job of running a lot of stuff, but also having other crazy stuff in her life that kind of gives her purpose. And I think you can be successful at this balancing act. You just have to be able to compartmentalize it, where the things you do outside of running help you grow in all of life versus take away from what you're doing. I think people think like, oh, if instead of sitting on my ass on the couch, like I'm up and doing this and doing that, that's going to affect my recovery. But they think of that in like a purely physical standpoint. And if you're doing something passionate, maybe creative with your life or something that gives you energy, like you can, it can aid your overall well-being and also your recovery if you enjoy doing that, and in turn benefit your running. But it's got to be something to that degree, if that makes sense. So
yeah,
I think it's about finding things that you're passionate about and pursuing them, and you can make it work.
Yeah, I mean, I agree 100%, Phoebe. I mean, I use a lot of the post-collegiate athletes I work with. Like, my wife is the number one example. You know, she's a full-time physical therapist, works 40 hours a week, 4 days a week, 10-hour shifts. You know, she only has 3 days a week to work out, but we hit it on those 3 days, so Wednesday and then Saturday and Sunday, and we get her fit. And she came out of school, 10 years ago as a 17, 15 girl, and she ran 15:57 on the track last year, which isn't anything crazy or, you know, just like scratching at national class, but she's been to a couple U.S. championships. She's, you know, competed at that high level, not making the world team, not being professional, but found a lot of value in her continuous improvement despite this schedule that most people will be like, oh, I have to work 10-hour shifts. There's no way I can run and train and be fast. I mean, it's complete folly. I think, you know, what happens is what I notice about the sport in general, and this is me getting on my soapbox, so everyone feel free to turn off the podcast if you like, is we get a lot of micromanager coaches and agents who are just saying, it needs to be exactly like this, and you do exactly as I say, the exact prescription I give you. And if you go, you know, deviate beyond the prescription, there's no way you can be successful, because I, as the coach, know that I'm going to get this manipulation of whatever physiological standpoint or mental standpoint I'm trying to enact if you just do exactly as I say. Versus the reality is, with training, we don't know. We're always evolving our training theory, and we're always evolving, you know, with research that comes out or different applications about how things are packaged and what benefits. Like, we really don't know. So to say, like, my way is the way or hit the highway is a little bit of, you know, to me, you know, unnecessary hubris, because it's like, we need to constantly be learning, not only as athletes, but as coaches and, you know, as people who are championing the sport in general. And part of that comes from, like Steve said, being passionate about things that you really engage and capture your heart and mind, and having fun with it. I think a passionate person is a person who's living vitally, fully, to the absolute maximum. And if you just, like for you, you're a polymath of sorts. You know, Phoebe, just knowing you, it's like you need to do a variety of things to keep the variety of things that you do at a high level and keep you engaged in all the things you're doing, versus you try to be inauthentic to who you are and do one thing and try to say, I got to do this one thing very well. You know, for that personality, your personality, it's not going to result in what you want to see achieved. And I think you just have to know the personalities you're coaching. And if that type of person is this monastic type individual who needs to go and do that. Now, I do believe in, like, say, altitude training blocks or something, not only for the physiological benefits, but just for kind of like the recalibrating benefits of, hey, we're going to work hard for a condensed period of time, but there's an end date to it. There's light at the end of the tunnel. It's a, you know, 28-day block, and then you're done. It's not, you know, a forever block. It's not, or, you know, year to year, it's like we have that time where you can put in that work, get a lot of benefit, and now come back to reality. So I think we just have to do a better job at realizing, like, there's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of the world to see, and most people aren't going to be, you know, content with just doing one thing really, really, really well. I mean, you know, you're always going to get a lot of pleasure out of what your passion is. Like, I work, you know, as a coach, I mean, and Steve can attest, like, we don't make millions, we're not in it to get rich, but we do it because we love it. We coach people for zero to nothing to a bunch, depending. But the thing is, like, that no one really knows, like, I would pretty much coach everyone for free if I didn't have to, you know, make money. You know, because it's just so much fun. Like, you just say, hey, John, will you coach you? Yeah, I'll do it. It's fun. It's a fun, you know, puzzle game for me. I mean, all these, you know, schools I pay for, like, I'd be a volunteer coach just as long as they just let me coach. You know, it's like, oh, great. But, you know, you got to make a living and you got to do that to survive in the world. But if I ever had, like, a, you know, trust fund or won the lottery, if I won, like, $1 million in the lottery, I'd still be coaching. And I'd just do it for free. I just coach and be like, hey, I'm set. I'm just going to coach people up all day because I love it. And once you find that passion, though, I think it's really easy not to get distracted by the BS, as you talked about earlier. And so you don't have to do it as long as you're in the right environment with the right coach who knows your personality type. I think so often we say, here's the physiological workout system. And as people who listen to this pod know, Steve and I rarely, if ever, talk about workouts and recipes for workouts. And we say, you just follow the system and you'll get faster. And but, like, as you alluded to earlier, Phoebe, like, work is work. And, you know, when I loved it when you ranked down on 10th, like, the workouts in terms of what makes a good professional career. You know, the critical things that make a professional career. And, you know, it's much more an emotional component because you have to want to be doing what you're doing. Otherwise, no sponsorship, contract, bonus, or, you know, prestige in the world is going to propel you to continue it if you don't love it. I mean, you know, we all know that there's a lot of success stories of people who just do it because they love it, even in, like, the middle of distance ranks, like Chanel Price, Maggie Vessey, yourself. I mean, all these women had contracts, you know, had reductions or got dropped or this or that, you know, and were making zero to nothing off of it, but still continue to do it because they absolutely love it. And I think those are the types of people I champion the most and want to see do well. Being unbiased, you know, as unbiased as I try to be, is because when I know someone's doing this because they love it, then I can resonate with that as, you know, a coach, administrator, and former athlete.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
So, all right. Well, I think we better start wrapping up the show, Steve. It's been like over an hour of us giving Phoebe 20 questions here.
Thanks for answering our 20 questions. We sure grilled you and asked a bunch of vulnerable questions. So I appreciate your honesty.
No problem.
Hope everyone enjoyed it. As I said, as we kind of talked about, I think there's a lot of gems in this talk about how to live as a professional, some of the misconceptions that are around in the sport, and, you know, how to get the sport better. So thanks to Phoebe for coming on, and thanks to John, as always, for sparking some conversation. Hope you guys enjoyed it, and we'll have another episode soon.
All right, everyone, stay caffeinated and stay educated. Don't ever stop learning or drinking coffee. That's my 2 cents.